All right, well, let's get after it. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 10, and we're actually going to start in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And so you may get to both of those texts. Let me give you a brief update, and this is actually an update for our missions team, too, because it's the first time I've seen you all since I've been home. I got a call from Brother Mears, and there seems to be a bit of a change of schedule to our plans, so men and church family. Be in prayer for the city of Mumbua, and there seems to be a possibility, a large possibility, of an open door there. And there's a man by the name of Roderick. And he was reached in Lusaka about a year ago and had been real super faithful for about 6-8 months and grew like a weed and just disappeared. Well, the missions team that's there and coming home, I think they're actually back home now, that was there this past week, found him and went and visited him. And there's a couple of families meeting with him and no church in the city of Mumbua. And so there's a large possibility. We're going to land in Lusaka, do a little bit of work there, move to Mumbua for a couple of days, then out to Mongu, and then back to Mumbua before we come back. And so you men, if you have questions for me afterwards, I'll try to fill you in. But Brother Mears was saying part of the journey of missions is just being flexible and being limber and being willing to kind of adjust and figure out where the door is. And I was telling him, I said, I'm just happy to try to learn. And we're trying to learn so we can come and do, and we can go and do. And so keep that in prayer if you would. If you remember his name, Roderick and Mumbua. And for you men in the group, Mumbua is the 1/3 of the way to Mongu stop that we had on our list. So keep that in prayer. Well, I'm eager to preach tonight for a couple of reasons. One, because I think the text is awesome. Two, because I only get to preach like 3 times in a whole month. And so either my sermons, I'm either going to forget how to do this, or I'm just going to preach a really, really long time next time I get to preach to you all. And so I'm not totally sure what's going to happen. I will have 60 hours on an airplane to write sermons. And so be ready for that. I'm excited about it. Well, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, I was a little bit jealous that Brother Magno got it because it's a great chapter. And I'm sure he did a fantastic job with it. But it talks about, at least it opens up the chapter with the one event that happens to all men. Happens to the wise and the unwise. Happens to those who make sacrifice and those who don't make sacrifice. The rich and the poor. There's just no escaping that reality. And it's a hard reality. And it's a reality that touches your life and it touches my life. And that is, we are all still very much under the curse that we will all someday perish. And in that chapter, it talks about how the dead, they know nothing, but the living know and can lay it to their heart that, hey, we are marching toward the end of this life. And I was listening on Sunday at the church my wife grew up at, and the preacher was talking about, I think we sang the song Saved, Saved, Saved. And he said, listen, there's nothing greater than that statement, saved. He said, you could be a millionaire, but that ends. But being saved never ends. And I thought, oh man, that's good. He said, you could have a huge house, but that eventually ends. But being saved never ends. And just the privilege of being able to be counted righteous, to be having his righteousness imputed to us, that someday we will be in heaven with Jesus Christ. And no matter what we face in this life, and we are his, we are redeemed. But we are in this life, however, and chapter 9 reminds us, we are securely under that portion of the curse. And the fact of the matter is, we've been freed from the dominion of sin. And sin has no more reign over us. And Jesus freed us from that. He gave us dominion over sin. And in and through Jesus, we have dominion over the world to a certain extent. And all that will be fully brought to fruition as Jesus returns. But the idea is, in chapter number 9, and I'm not trying to re-preach anything. This has been near and dear to my heart. There's just no escaping that reality that all men will eventually come to the grave. And Jesus has rescued us from that final reality that, hey, the grave isn't over, but there is still a physical death that has dominion over us. And this is a passage I've been drawing strength from, and I just want to throw it at you this evening. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse number 24, if you would. This is something that each of us can lay to our own hearts. We got to teach our children this reality that, hey, death does come. And obviously, age appropriate to everyone. You don't want to scare your little kids, but it's something that we're working on right now in our family. Teaching them just the reality that the curse is still partially intact. And 1 Corinthians is a passage I've been reading to my kids. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 24 says, then cometh the end, and this is a prophecy and a promise to us believers, then cometh the end when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, for he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. And that's going to be at the very end. And I want you to notice when Jesus finishes it all and he puts everything back to his Father, notice the last enemy that he destroys. Verse 26. And the last enemy that shall be destroyed is, would you read it out loud? Death. I draw great comfort from that truth. I want my kids to rest in that truth. I want my church family to rest in that truth that, hey, we are still somewhat under the curse of sin in that we will die and bones do break and heartache does come and cancer does come. And he has rescued us from the dominion of sin, but someday he will destroy even death itself. And that's chapter number 9. He just says, hey, lay it to heart. It's coming. Be ready for it. Prepare yourselves for it. You're not going to live forever under the sun. But thank God Jesus will someday conquer even that enemy. Now let's move into chapter number 10. Chapter number 10 and chapter 11 are very similar in that they are great everyday wisdom for the believer. And this particular chapter holds some really powerful advice for life. Let me give you kind of two primary things he's going to deal with. It's not all that he'll talk about, but the two primary things he's going to deal with is our tongue and our relationship toward authority. And that's a unique study that we're getting ready to embark upon, because he seems to suggest that sometimes authority's right, and here's how we should behave, and that when authority's wrong, hey, here's how we should behave. And then there's a large portion, two different portions kind of sandwiched in there that deal with our tongue, and in a large portion of the text dealing with our speech and our gossip and things of that nature. So be ready to learn some things on that. There's some really great verses in here, very akin to Solomon's other book, the book of Proverbs. And there's some verses worth memorizing. In fact, as I was working in Florida, just reading over my texts for study, I came to this particular passage. I've been working on memorizing a particular verse in chapter number 10. I'll point it out to you. And I suggest you probably will want to memorize it as well. It's something I need, something I'm working on, something some of you might be working on as well. So let's dive into our study. We've prayed, and so let's lean into the text. And if you're just joining us for the first time, I do see some visitors out there. Thank you for coming. And we're going through this book, the book of Ecclesiastes. If you find the middle of your Bible, just go to the right, just a couple of pages probably. And you'll find the book of Ecclesiastes, the book inspired by God through Solomon. And Solomon is at a very different spot in his life than he was when he wrote the book of Proverbs. Proverbs, you see God's wisdom. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, you still see God's wisdom intact, but you're seeing this from the perspective of a man who is not right with God. And he is an idolater. He is a womanizer. He will spend what seems to be the rest of his life away from God. Though in chapters 10, 11, and 12, there are these brief moments of like, hey, I do know I'm wrong. And then the book ultimately ends with the conclusion of the whole matter in chapter 12, and we'll see that in 2 weeks from now. But this particular book is a profound look at what life is like under the sun. And we as Christians, thankfully, don't live our life for under the sun. We live our life under Jesus, and our kingdom is someday coming, and our king is someday coming, and this life is, we're just pilgrims on a journey through this foreign land, and we're marching to Jesus. And a lot of the things that Solomon says that are reality in this life, to us, don't have that same sting, because we're living for something different than just the paycheck and just the you know, we want everything to be fair. And he's going to talk a lot about the unfairness of life in this book and really in this chapter too. So let's lean in and let's gather some wisdom for life in chapters 10, 11, and 12. So chapter 10, verse number 1 says this, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. Now, there's a couple of things you got to realize. Let's kind of work backwards. The word savor, not the word savior, but savor is scent or smell. The word ointment is a perfumed oil. And then something that you might not know is apothecary is not a place. It's actually a person. And so that's really important. It's a person who by their trade and skill and study, they're a craftsman who labors to produce beautiful fragrances for enjoyment. And so this isn't a medicinal ointment. Oftentimes we'll think about, you know, that ointment for that rash. Don't tell me about your rash, but that might be what you're thinking in your mind. That's not what Solomon's talking about. Solomon is talking about a perfume. And what he's telling us here is that a man, not a place, an apothecary is not a place, it's a person. An apothecary is someone who labors. And the Bible tells us here that a man could labor and he could gather the perfumes and the spices and the oils and complementing aromas. And he could put them together in the appropriate balance and measure and 2 drops of this and 4 drops of that and labor to create something absolutely beautiful. And it'd be ruined by a few dead flies that made their way into the ointment. Think about this, ladies, Chanel number 5 with maggots in it. Okay? Chanel number 5, I don't know much about perfume. I avoid the mall at all costs, and I certainly avoid the perfume section at all costs, but I don't know what the big perfumes are out there, and I'm good with, you know, the old school Old Spice, or some of you teenage boys still use an Axe, so you can get past that, but the idea is that this apothecary, this man, can labor and work and be skilled and a craftsman and put together something beautiful and balanced to present for the enjoyment of those around him, but it can be ruined by just a couple of things inside of the oil. So now we understand the first part of verse number one. Now let's look at the second. Verse one says, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly, so that's the flies, him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. So that's why it's important to recognize that apothecary is not a place, but a person. This person has labored and put together beautiful aromas and collected these measures of spices and oils, and he made something beautiful and fragrant that would otherwise be very well received and very well appreciated, and yet it's ruined by a few little flies in his ointment. And then the Bible goes on to say, in similar fashion, so doth a little bit of foolishness a man that has a reputation of wisdom and honor. So let's bring that into our day. A wise man can labor his entire life. And this is a hard reality, but it's an inescapable reality. A man can labor his entire life and build a powerful testimony that is both Christ-honoring and effective. You think about the prayer of a righteous man, it's effectual and it's fervent. It avails much. A man can live his entire life building this robust catalog of wisdom and knowing how to live in purity and propriety or piety and be careful in his decision makings. And then all of it can be ruined with a few foolish decisions. Just like you ladies, if your husband gave you on your anniversary Chanel number 5 with a few maggots at the bottom of the bottle and you'd not use it because it makes it disgusting, so it is the man who lives his entire life or the woman who lives her entire life building a testimony, serving Jesus. And I'm not talking about living to build a testimony. When you live for Jesus, he builds your testimony for you. But the fact of the matter is you can live your entire life and do so many things right. You can measure and gather and balance and perfect harmony these beautiful sacrifices to Jesus. A good name takes a lifetime to build and only a short time to ruin entirely. And some of us know different people, and I certainly do. I know pastors who by their own foolish decisions, whether they were protecting themselves or other people, and maybe they were covering sin, or maybe they themselves sinned, and I don't downplay anything, but a lifetime of laboring to serve Jesus and a few moments of foolishness, and the ointment is no longer receivable. It's one of those things where, man, if I heard that preacher was preaching at that meeting, because that preacher is there, I will not go. And I'm not saying I'm being judgmental. I think that's a wise decision because that ointment has a stinking savor to it. And the fact of the matter is you can build your entire life around Jesus, and for a few moments of selfishness, a few moments of foolishness, a few terrible decisions, though you feel they may be small, you can darnish your entire testimony. And therefore, church family, let me admonish us to be careful. To be careful of the small things. And that's one of the traps of the devil. Oh, it's just a small thing. Yeah, like when kings should go forth to battle. Just a little thing. A bird by wandering, a swallow by flying. He leaves his nest at the wrong time, the Bible says in the book of Proverbs. That's a dangerous thing to kind of happen upon. Seemingly small things like a couple of flies can ruin an otherwise beautiful, fragrant masterpiece of a life. So we need to guard ourselves. And I want you to think about your own particular sense in life and maybe your own besetting area. What is it that you would say, hey, you know what, I'm growing here, but man, there's an area that I really need to guard. Perhaps you need to guard your tongue. Because the fact of the matter is a few cross words spoken in haste can ruin a testimony. A quick answer right away that you thought, no, this is right, that can ruin a lifetime of building a reputation of honor. What does the Bible say? It goes back, doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. We need to guard our tongue. We need to guard our testimony, right? Or our temper, rather. We need to guard our temper. Oftentimes, in a flash of frustration, we can say something or post something or rebuttal, and all of a sudden, something that would have otherwise smelled fragrant and beautiful now has a tinge of rottenness to it. In fact, the very word abomination, and there's a handful of abominations in the Bible. One particular one is gossip, and this particular chapter deals in a large part of that. The idea of an abomination is the Hebrew word pegul, and its first appearance is in the book of Leviticus to describe meat that is rotting. And it's an abomination. It cannot be received. It's something that would not be acceptable. And again, I've used this illustration before. There are some things that I really don't like, but if I had to and I was starved, you know, I would eat it. If someone served it to me, to be polite, I would eat it. There's a handful of those things. But if you were to serve me meat with maggots in it, then I couldn't receive that. I would hate to embarrass you and me, but I would have to say, hey, you know what? The fact of the matter is I cannot receive that. There's some things I don't like, and I'll receive it if I must. but there are some things I won't receive. And that's what God calls sowing discord among the brethren. And we need to be careful of our testimony and our tongue. I would say this, there's not a lot, and the Bible backs this up, there's not a lot of things that ruin a testimony quite like sexual sins. You can live an entire lifetime, and for just a few moments of foolishness, ruin your entire testimony. In fact, the Bible tells us in Proverbs 6:32, I'll read it for you, but whoso committeth adultery, and that's a contrast to other sins. He says, but whoso committeth adultery with the woman lacketh understanding. And he that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. And notice what he gets. A wound and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. Some things sometimes lead to big things, or rather small things, sometimes lead to big things. But let me say this, even if they never lead to big things, they can still be the small flies in the ointment of a faithful, otherwise faithful apothecary who does his job well, but now, oh man, I've ruined my testimony. And the fact of the matter is, a ruined testimony can be rebuilt, and some of the text today in the rest of the passage will deal with some of that. But now let's move on to verse number 2. He says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Now, this isn't describing the anatomy of a wise person. His heart is on his right side, and a foolish man has his heart on his left side, because we all have our heart kind of center and left. But it's not talking about the description of where his heart is, but it's talking about that idea of position of accessibility. And we understand that Jesus is seated at the right hand of the Father. He's positioned for accessibility. You've ever heard the phrase, he's my right hand man. Okay, position for accessibility. And so for a wise man, his heart is ready, accessible to make decisions that are proper. He's engaged and his heart is present. His wisdom is there to help make good decisions versus those foolish ones that would destroy the work of the apothecary. But a fool, his heart is somewhere. It's not here and ready to be engaged. And he shows up to church and like, I'm ready. I want to engage. I want to listen. I'm not going to be goofing off or laughing or drawing. I want to be present. My heart is here and it's engaged. Whereas a fool would walk into the same building and hear the same sermon and have the same opportunity to sing and worship. And his heart is, it's somewhere, but it's not present and accessible. I love this next verse, but it's kind of hard to read. Some of these verses, they're very, very pungent. Look at verse 3. Yea, also, so in the same line of thinking, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, he's just going throughout his life, his wisdom, and everybody has some measure of wisdom. Everybody's got some life experience, and, you know, I've walked this road, and, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. You know, there's some street smarts, but even his wisdom, the fool's wisdom, as he's walking through life, his wisdom, what does the Bible say? Faileth him. So there comes a point when even the wise fool, right? And that's what sophomore means. No offense to you sophomores in high school, but it means wise fool. You're somewhat experienced, but you're not super experienced. You're when someone who's walking through this life has a kind of a fragrance of wisdom, well, his wisdom will fail him eventually. And look at the rest of verse 3. And he saith to everyone that he is a fool. And so a foolish man can walk through this life with a certain amount of expected wisdom gained again through age or experience. He would even consider himself to be a wise person. He's seen things and watched things. He's no fool, but he may present well. But as life happens, the Bible tells us, it uses this idea of his wisdom just kind of folding in on itself. His wisdom fails. It's like almost, it's like a cardboard box when it gets wet. It just crumples. There's no substance or strength to it. Sure, there's a form, but nothing is sufficient to supply strength. And he, by his terrible decision-making, plainly reveals to all what? The contents of his heart, that he's a fool. And so for a little while, he might present well, and he can show up and look real good, but eventually when rubber meets the road and there's an opportunity for sin or an opportunity for a foolish decision, and he might look real well, but eventually his wisdom will fail him, and he'll declare to all people the contents of his own heart that he is a fool. So he can hide for a while, but eventually any man's eyes can look and see what's on the inside. Now, this next part brings us into some really great everyday wisdom when dealing with authority. And I want you to ask yourself the question. And as you're interpreting the Bible, you need to ask yourself questions, okay? You got to be a student of the word. And here's the question I want you to ask. Is he saying the leader's right or that the follower is right? Or does he not even say? So pay attention. Look at verse number 4. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. So whose offenses? Well, it doesn't seem to suggest either the king's or yours. And in fact, he's going to reinforce that same idea of, hey, either one, because he's not saying, now let me say this, being that it seems to be an either one, he's wrong and I'm right, and so, hey, I shouldn't run, I should yield, and I should, you know, pacify great offense, or if maybe he was right and I was wrong, and now I'm afraid and I'm embarrassed, I'm going to run, or should I just stick it out? He isn't really addressing who's right and who's wrong. What he is addressing is staying where you can be used and access the king. We've already seen that, and you don't have to go back, but if you go back to chapter number 8, you may be right on the leaflet of your Bible, the first couple verses of chapter 8 deal with that idea, right? Don't be hasty to leave the presence of the king, because he's going to make a decision, and after he makes that decision, it's too late for you to decide, well, I don't like that decision. If you had a position of influence, use that position of influence. And here he is submitting to us, don't give up that position of influence if you're in the presence of a ruler. But here he goes on and says that if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. So if you have offended authority, whether it was your fault or his fault, what he's telling us is don't just throw in the towel and throw yourself a pity party like, he treated me unfairly, or, I made a huge mistake, I'm so embarrassed, I gotta run and hide myself. No. Yield and try to bridge that relationship back. If you have an opportunity and a relationship with the ruler, and that relationship is breached somehow by you or by them, don't just, I'm leaving the church. No. Don't give up on that quickly. Those relationships do matter. Do what's right. If you are wrong, then stick around and yield, and your yielding will pacify a great offense. You'll rebuild that testimony that we talked about in a couple of verses ago. But again, the ruler is right and you're wrong. Hey, own it and take your lickings. But it also works if the ruler is not right and you were the one in the right. Well, your patient forbearing for the sake of your influence is a worthy investment. Hey, he was wrong to me. Okay. Hey, go ahead and yield to the situation and try to have influence. In fact, I would write in the corner of your Bible next to that verse, or you could turn over there with me, Proverbs 25:15. Same man, different book. Talking about very much the same thing. Okay? And again, he's not telling us who's right and who's wrong. He just says there's an offense between you and a ruler. His anger rises up against you. Should you just run or stick it out and try to make it work? Well, he says stick it out and try to make it work. But in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 15, he says, by long forbearing is a prince. And that word prince doesn't just mean the son of a king, okay? It means ruler, leader, governor, king. It can be from the top to the bottom of leadership. By long forbearing is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bones. So what is he going after here, both in Proverbs and in Ecclesiastes? Essentially, he's saying, don't be rash in your decision because of your immediate passions, okay? Don't be so quick to be like, the relationship has a breach in it. Throw it out. How often do people do that? When there's a bit of a breach in a relationship, especially with an authority, right? Man, my employee, or rather my employer, you got frustrated at me, you got mad at me. I'm putting in my 2 weeks notice. I'm out of here. Well, I think that Solomon is submitting that we stick around and rebuild our testimony. And that we have that influence with a king or our employer or our boss or our pastor. There's some relationship there with somebody. Don't be so quick when something breaks to just throw it away and be like, all right, I'm walled up. That person can't affect me. That Sunday school teacher, that pastor, that person, nope, get away from me. And again, oftentimes we leave because we're embarrassed, we did something wrong, or we leave because we're self-righteous and we think they did something wrong. And either of those, he says right here, hey, yield, patient forbearance, you can move past offenses. The unfortunate reality is that in any relationship with authority, there are going to come times where there are breaches in that relationship. And sometimes you were the one wrong, and sometimes the authority was the one wrong. But at least in this verse, Solomon is saying, in an everyday right answer, whether it's their fault or your fault, don't throw away that relationship. Don't run from that relationship. Be slow. Yield. Be patient. Restore that relationship. If we threw away every relationship that had a small fracture in it, we wouldn't have any relationships, would we? If every time we got on an offense with our husband, oh man, I can't handle this. I'm out of here. Okay, well then that's a problem. You're not going to have any relationships long term. And so here he's submitting, hey, yield, pacify great anger. Verse number 5. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. So again, he's talking about dealing with authority. And he says, I've watched as a king myself, I've seen different rulers. There's an evil that comes from their actions. And it's not what we were talking about a second ago. It's the next couple of verses. He's going to tell us exactly what that error is. I've watched kings make this decision, and see if you've ever seen this. I would submit you probably have. He says, so here's the error. Folly. Brother Jim Phillips is calling me. Hey, Brother Jim. he says, folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. Now, understand rich is not talking about those who have a lot of money, but he's talking about those who are honorable in their behavior. He says, so folly, a foolish man, is put in a position of dignity, and a rich and honorable man is set low. So here's this great injustice that comes from kings, he says. Fools are appointed by kings to rule in positions of nobility, while the truly noble are given low places. Have you ever seen that in your workplace, perhaps? The lazy guy is the guy that gets the office and the promotion. The dishonest guy gets the company car. The man with no character ends up being elevated. I've certainly seen that in my own life. Maybe at times in Bible college, someone who, you know, like in the dorms, we knew had no character. And then all of a sudden, they're the ones teaching junior church. And they're like, that guy didn't even go to class. And that's just how things happen. That's just the reality of it. In fact, he's going to continue on the same line of thinking in verse 7. He says, I have seen servants upon horses. So that idea of marching in a parade, I've seen those lowly be elevated, and then princes walking as servants upon the earth. Now, again, he's not saying that it's a terrible injustice when a person in royalty ends up a pauper. No, no, no. Again, he has already declared this to be an unrighteous thing. And so what he's submitting to us is that there are those who should rule who don't, and those who shouldn't rule who end up ruling. And let's tie this all back in, and it's going to bring us to our next couple of verses. Some people who do it right anger the king. Some who do it wrong gain his favor. Those are the last couple of verses all kind of tied into one big idea. These are two competing realities, but these realities are reality. That sometimes you do everything right and the authority is offended. Sometimes you do everything wrong and the authority's like, you know what? You should be in charge of this. So what do we do with that reality? Can we escape that reality? Look at verse number 8. He carries it forward. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. Now, we've seen that. Solomon has said that in the book of Proverbs. You roll a stone, it falls back on you. You dig a pit for a trap, you're going to fall therein. Okay, so we got a guy here who's digging a pit. He's a nefarious man. He lays a trap. He's going to fall into that trap. Woo, good. Then it says, and whoso breaketh an hedge. That'd be like your gate. You know, you fortified your house. Someone's breaking down the wall to try to get in. Notice what happens to that guy. A serpent shall bite him. Okay, so there are those who do it right and they offend the king. There are those who do it wrong and they are advanced. Okay, well, good. Oh, it's all balanced out in verse number 8. We might think it's not. In verse number 8, he says, yeah, and the guy who digs a pit to capture someone, he falls into it. And the guy who tears down a wall to get into somebody's stuff, he ends up getting bit by a snake. Okay, justice is served. Well, look at verse number 9. Whoso removeth, and that word removeth means to quarry, to dig out, to mine, to gather stones. So a miner, someone doing honest work, they're not tearing down somebody's wall. They're just mining rocks to themselves. Notice what happens to the person doing it right. Shall be hurt therewith. Now you might say, well, maybe he was the guy that was breaking down the wall. Well, the next part of this verse suggests that he was doing, these are good people. It says, and he that cleaveth wood. This is just a man who's just chopping wood. He's cutting down trees. He may be building the house. He might be preparing for winter. There is no even remote suggestion this man is doing anything nefarious, nor the previous man in verse number 9. Who that removeth stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. It's equal and opposite. So you got a guy over here, he does it wrong and he gets advanced. But that same guy digs a pit and falls into it. That same guy tears down to take over and he gets bit by a snake. Okay, it's just. Well, then the other side is true too. This is life under the sun, and we've all seen it, right? I'm thankful Solomon at least presents the reality. These are things we think. Like, how come that guy gets away with it? And then this guy over here, he does everything right, and he offends the king. He's chopping down wood, and he's quarrying and working and building stuff, and all of a sudden now he gets hurt carrying the rocks, or he gets hurt with the wood that he's chopping. Why does this happen? This is reality of life under the sun, because we live in a broken world. and broken people lead, and foolish people get advanced, and wise people get hurt, and good people get hurt. And that's just the reality that Solomon is bringing to us, as painful as it might be. It is wise to notice. And let me just speak from my present experience. It is wise to realize that, because then you don't get blindsided when a good person that you love is suffering. You say, I thought if you lived right, there'd never be any heartache. No, sometimes the guy who's quarrying, sometimes the guy who's cutting wood, he gets hurt by it. Yeah, and sometimes the guy over there that does it wrong, he gets advanced. And that is maddening if we do not recognize this is life under the sun. This is the result of the curse. This is because we live amongst broken people who are sinners, and sinners have authority. And we're not ever going to take over this kingdom and establish it as righteous until Jesus himself comes back. But there is an advantage. And we've seen Solomon say that, right? In every instance so far that I've seen, where Solomon kind of presents this like, nothing we can do about it, he does give us a, but there is something you can do about it. It doesn't change the reality. It's kind of like when he talks about the hardship of life and, hey, so enjoy yourself. Hey, rejoice with the wife of your youth in the past chapter. And he says, hey, you know, you're not going to be able to keep the riches. It's like the rain that goes up and falls into the rivers and gives over to the oceans, and the oceans get taken by the clouds and that whole thing. And he says, yeah, but enjoy it. You can't stop it. You can't change it, but enjoy it. He does give us something here. So this guy, he's doing it wrong. He's digging a pit, and he falls in. He gets bit by that serpent, but also at the same time, sometimes he gets advanced. And he's on the horse when the nobleman is walking. Okay, so what do we do with that? Well, then over here, it's the same thing, but it's the opposite. So what do we do with that? There is somewhat of a solution, at least not a consolation, but a comfort. There is some advantage. And we saw that chapter 8, but he talks about how, hey, the race is, chapter number 8, I'm drawing a blank on it, but he submits the idea that there is a righteous man who is blessed, and he's preferred above others, and I think that's chapter 8. But look at verse number 10. He does submit to us a little bit of a consolation. He said, if the iron be blunt, he's talking about an axe that isn't sharp, and he do not whet the edge, doesn't sharpen that axe, then he must put to more strength. So he says, you got a dull axe, and you're trying to chop wood. He says, if you don't sharpen that axe, it's going to be harder for you to chop wood. So what was he saying? Well, sharpen your axe. Well, not really. Notice what a sharp axe is. But wisdom is profitable to direct. So let's bring that in. While it is true that sometimes you can't stop the bad guy from getting the corner office, sometimes he does get bit and falls into that pit. And there have been people, and I've shared some stories, but when I work secularly, there have been people who were wrong, and then they got advanced. And I got demoted, and just situations. You can't really do anything about that. And sometimes the good guy who does good work, honestly, he ends up getting hurt. But here's what he says. Wisdom does give you a sharper edge. Wisdom. So we've all heard this statement, and I'm not going to make you finish it, but life is hard, but it's harder if you're... Don't say that word. It's harder if you're foolish. It's a dull axe. Wisdom does profit. It is very, very difficult to get ahead, though it can be done. You can put more work in with a dull axe, and you can get advanced, and you can connive, and you can scheme, and you can dog eat dog, and you can get ahead. But wisdom is profitable. He says, but wisdom is profitable to direct. So you got this dull axe. That's a foolish man. You can do it, but you know what? Wisdom does give you a sharper edge. A dull axe requires you to put more strength in, but wisdom gives you an advantage in the unjust race of life under the sun. It's just an unjust race. It's part of the curse. And that part of the curse is still intact until Jesus takes over. Now, the next part of this Proverbs-like wisdom deals with our mouth. And we told you that was coming, so let's get after it. Look at verse number 11. In verse number 11, he says, surely, and this is a really sharp word picture, surely the serpent will bite without enchantment. You don't have to provoke a serpent to bite you. It's a snake. It will bite you, okay? You don't have to kick it. You don't have to poke it. If you're near enough to it for it to bite you, it's going to bite you without any extra work on your part. And a babbler, someone who speaks hollow words, is no better. You don't have to provoke a snake to bite you, and you don't have to provoke a gossip to talk poorly about you. It just happens. It's in a snake's nature to bite. It doesn't require any special enticement. It doesn't require any special provocation. It's a snake. It's going to bite. So a babbler is no better. They're going to find a reason to justify their fangs. A person who's going to gossip is going to find something. You don't have to enchant it. You don't have to provoke it. You don't have to have even been in the same room with them. They will find a reason to talk and babble hollow words, gossip, this talebearer, and this is a similar word to that, and you'll see it throughout the text. Solomon, unfortunately, is comparing this empty speaker to a snake who, for no reason at all, with no provocation, will find a reason to strike. And that's unfortunate. As we talked about, God hates gossip. It's that rotting meat. And we might justify it. Oh, it's just chat. It's just girl time. It's just guy time. It's just, yeah, you didn't need a reason to bite because it's in your nature, as it is in a snake's nature. Again, that's it. If you have a problem with that, again, the dentist only hits a nerve if there's a cavity. So verse number 12. He says, the words of a wise man. And here's the verse that, man, this the Lord has really impressed upon my heart. I'm trying to memorize this. I submit you do the same. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. So not only does this foolish person bite and hurt others, but this foolish person's lip will swallow themselves up. This is a verse worthy of committing to memory. Let's kind of break it down. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious. That word gracious means this: favorable, kindness bestowed toward others, good-willed. Does this word gracious, does this describe your communication on your way to church today? Gracious, does it describe your text message history or your posting history? Gracious, goodwill toward, kindness bestowed upon, favorable. Does it describe your conversations about church people? How do we speak about the person who we might be less favorable toward? Are we speaking goodwilled? How does this describe how we speak to our spouse? Because the lips of a wise man or the words of a wise man are gracious. How about the way we speak to our children? Is this a word that would describe it? Good-willed, kind-natured, favorable. Or does the last half of the verse better describe our mouth? The lips of a fool will swallow up himself. Let me ask, how often, this is a good way to kind of figure out where do I fall. How often do your words come back to bite you? Okay? How often do your words get you in trouble? How often do your conversations make it to other people? That, man, I was talking about that person, now they know about that person. What's happening? Your words are swallowing you up. It's the flies in the ointment of you as an apothecary, spending your life trying to do something for Jesus, and your words keep getting in your way. There's a couple of statements that over the course of the last year or so, God's been really working in my heart about. One, and I've said it before in preaching, but love is never the wrong answer, right? Charity never faileth. It's always the right answer. Well, at the same time, here's something the Lord's been teaching me about. You will never regret being gracious. I want you to just think about that. You'll never, in any situation, you will never regret responding in graciousness. That's something I struggle with sometimes. That's something that I mess up on sometimes. And here's the reality. I've always regretted being unkind. I've never regretted being gracious. I've always regretted being passive aggressive. That's one of the worst forms of unkindness in my assessment. I'm being passive aggressive right now to you passive aggressive people. You know it. Some of you, no, I'm kidding. That's passive aggressive. I've always regretted speaking hastily. I've always regretted letting an inconvenience be known. Like, oh yeah, I can do that, but... But you know what I've never regretted after a phone call, after a conversation with someone? I've never regretted when there was an opportunity for me to be maybe sharp and the Holy Spirit held my foolish tongue and I was gracious. I've never gone home and said, oh man, I was too nice to that person. I was too well-favored to that person. But you know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't. Maybe the person that doesn't offend in word, the same as a perfect man, okay? So unless you're a perfect man, you associate with what I'm talking about right now. There have been things you've said and responses you've had or facial expressions you've made that were less than gracious. And you, if the Holy Spirit's inside of you, like I assume he is, you regretted those. But in the moments that you responded favorably, when there was wisdom in your mouth and you decided to bury an offense and just be kind, you've never regretted those moments. Well, I was too kind and then they took advantage of me. You know, I've really never ever felt that way. There's certainly been times where people took advantage of kindness and so forth, and you've experienced that. But that's unto Jesus. And you can be okay with that. And I can be okay with that. So the idea is love is never the wrong answer. And graciousness is always the wise answer. Something to live by. Maybe memorize that verse. So Solomon isn't done teaching us about our words. Look at verse number 13. It says, the beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous and madness. Through and through, from beginning to end, the fool has nothing wise to say. It's always foolish, and ultimately, from the front it's foolish, to the end it's madness. Nothing he says is beneficial. And even though his words are destroying him, and even though he only has foolish things to say, notice a rather comical observation Solomon makes. Verse number 14. A fool also is full of words. You know, it's funny. The people who have less to say a lot, right? Now, that's not always true. Certainly not. I hope that's not true. I speak more in the church than most of you. I hope that's not always true. But the fool, he's full of words. He uttereth all his mind. He doesn't keep it till afterwards like a wise man. The Bible says a fool's wrath is presently known. It's immediately known. He's got something to say. He's got an answer to it. He wants to be heard all the time on every matter. He has opinions. But notice what is in the multitude of his words. This is an interesting verse. So back up and read it. It says, a fool also is full of words. But notice, a man cannot tell what shall be. Listening to him, where's this going? And what shall be after him? Who can tell him? So in all the fool's speaking, in as much words, there's no clear direction or benefit. I don't even know what you're saying. I walked away from that conversation. I've got no idea where we were supposed to go with that. What comes next? What was this whole thing we were just discussing? You had a lot of words from the beginning to the end. It was folly and madness, and you spoke a lot, but I got nothing from it. Verse number 15, the labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them. It is hard to listen to a foolish person speak, because it is both purposeless, directionless. It may be fervent. It may be passionate. It may be informed with things outside of the Spirit and the Word of God. But there's nothing to glean from it. The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them because he knoweth not. This is a great observation. He, the fool, knoweth not how to go to the city. He can't make his way out of a wet paper bag. He can't make his way back into the city. The road goes into the city. He can't even stay on that path long enough to make it where everybody else can make it. He can't go into the city. So listen, a fool can't even get his own way back on a broad road to a place that he should be familiar with. This is a man who has no business teaching anyone, and yet he wants to teach everyone. And that's a concern. Keeping that in mind, the way of the fool, Solomon is going to transition in again to once again speaking about a king and how to deal with that. It says in verse 16, woe to thee, O land. So speaking to any people, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Now, most of us eat in the morning, okay? So it's not submitting that you can't have your Eggo, and certainly not suggesting you can't have your coffee. But what he's saying is a sad reality when your leaders behave like children, because children put themselves first. They look to their own desires first thing. They're selfish and self-indulgent. They're gonna take care of themselves and please themselves. And you'll see the contrast in the next verse that talks about eats for strength and not just for pleasure. But he's saying, hey, a child wakes up, and you know how it is if you have young children, right? The first thing they wake up, you're still in bed, and it's like, I want breakfast! Because it's selfish. Yourself. Oh, no, the kid. I was going to correct all my kids. They're not even in here. I'll make them listen to the video. No, I'm kidding. Kids put themselves first. And what a judgment to a nation when their king is a child. Behaves like a child, puts himself first like a child. What a judgment to, this is not what the text is saying, I understand that, but there's certainly some application by way of principle. What a judgment to a home when a husband puts himself first, seeks his own before the betterment of his own children and his family. What a judgment to a congregation if their pastor were that. What a judgment to any relationship should the leader be a child. And there's some interesting things that you and I should recognize, and we'll get to some principles in a minute. Now, on the contrary, look what he says in verse 17. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. They're not just partying. They're not waking up and getting to their own desires and their own pleasures. It's a blessing when you have a king ruling over you who learned how to rule. He's the son of a nobleman. He grew up with this studied idea of how should I lead people. He doesn't eat for pleasure. He eats for strength. He takes food in so that he could be a better vessel to honor to his people and to his family. He is a leader and a man who is self-controlled. Now, again, I don't know how we would fit that into our own context as a nation, as a land, but we could certainly fit that into our own kind of areas of that relate to kingdoms, our homes and families and so forth. So this is some good wisdom for all of us to consider for our own application. A couple of things I want to note just from these last two verses that I think we should look at. Number one, we shouldn't behave like children. And again, you say, oh, don't use the word children pejoratively. Okay, fair. But the Bible does, and Solomon does. It's not saying that kids are evil, and I'm certainly not of that persuasion. I love having children at Faith Baptist Church. It's a joy. You go to some churches, and children are a plague, you know, and it's like, hey, be quiet. Don't come in here. We're doing stuff. Well, I want our kids to be doing stuff. I want them to be in that. I want them to be a part of that. I want them to pray and be a part of Lord's Supper and so forth. But there is a certain behavior of a child. And again, Jesus uses children as an example of faith. But Solomon uses children as an example of self-indulgence and selfishness. And so all of us, men, women, teenagers, don't behave like children. Be an adult. Number two, we shouldn't put our own self-satisfaction and our pleasure first. As leaders in any capacity, whether let alone being a king, but being an employer or an employee or a shift lead, we shouldn't put ourselves and our own self-satisfaction before other people and the needs of other people. A good leader's not going to do that. And then the last thing, this is kind of not off topic, but it's a good observation. Those things that can be pleasurable in life, and there are many, should be taken for strength and not merely for self-indulgence. He already said that, right? It's a blessing when you have a king who's the son of a noble and he eats in due season, and that he eats for strength and not for self-indulgence, not for his own pleasure. So there are things in life that God designed to be enjoyable. One of those is food, right? In heaven, we'll eat the marriage supper of the Lamb. It's a blessing. But in this passage, he tells us that we ought to be eating to strengthen our bodies, not just to indulge ourselves. And that cuts. I feel you. I'm there. We're all on a journey. We all got to get better. We got to make improvements week after week. But here he tells us that hey, it's a good thing to have a leader who has himself in check. But there are other things that are enjoyable in life. Let me give you a couple. Sexual intimacy. That should be something that God says, hey, I gave this to you. It's a blessing. But you ought to do it to strengthen, not just self-indulge. Well, how does that fit? Well, the way that God designed intimacy is for a marriage to be strengthened, to become one flesh, to be unified, not just to satisfy your own selfishness, but to strengthen. And if you do it right, and this is certainly not a time or a place or a topic to cover, but the fact of the matter is, it ought to be not for just self-indulgence, but for strengthening of this relationship, just like food, just like rest. In fact, the next verse is going to deal with that. Rest is a good thing, but not just for self-satisfaction, but for strength. God is for enjoying, but those enjoyments should have a beneficial purpose, not just simply self-gratification. So some closing thoughts for the night are found in verse number 18. Look at it says, by much slothfulness, the building decayeth. And this again is very much like Proverbs, where there's sometimes there's just disjointed, really good thoughts that aren't necessarily connected, and that's certainly all right. He says, by much slothfulness, the building decayeth, and through idleness of hands, the house droppeth through. So here's the idea. Persistent failure to steward the things that we have lead to decay, okay? We know that's true in our house, right? We were just gone for 9 days. We came back, and my goodness, there are weeds everywhere in the backyard. We sprayed before we left, and apparently it didn't work. And now we have left it to itself, and it has tended toward decay, right? And so we got to get out there and work. You don't clean the front of the house. You don't clean the bedrooms. By persistent failure to steward, the house drops through. It'll fall down on its own self. That's true of our houses. That's true of our gardens. That's true of our bodies. Persistent failure to steward. That's true of our marriages. A persistent failure to steward. And I get it. There are some times, man, you got a bad day. You got a bad, maybe bad week, or maybe there's a tough season you walk through in marriage, and we've all experienced that. But here's the problem. Persistent failure. That's what he's talking about. By persistently neglecting your house, it will decay. By persistently neglecting, doing it wrong, that house is going to fall in on itself. That's true of our church. That's true of our spiritual relationship with one another. If we persistently and consistently have a bad heart towards someone and have a less than gracious tongue towards someone, that consistent, persistent, poor behavior is going to cause the house to fall in on itself. That's true of relationships. That's true of our finances. And oftentimes what happens is we find ourselves in the position where the house has fallen in, and we're like, I don't know how it got here. Years and years and years of doing it wrong. And that's really tough as a counselor. And I'm for counseling. I enjoy that process. But here's the thing. It didn't break in a day. It won't be fixed in a day. Your house took a long time to fall in on itself. It's going to take some time to rebuild that. That testimony took a long time to build, and it's taken. Then it's fallen in on itself. It's going to take some time to rebuild that idea. You've got years and years of neglect of physical health. It's going to take some time to rebuild that. By idleness of hands, the house collapses into itself. So therefore, don't be idle in your marriage. Don't be slothful in your relationships. Don't persistently neglect the things God gave you to steward. Houses don't crumble in a day. They're not rebuilt in a day either. Look at verse number 19. An interesting statement here to consider. He says, a feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry. So he says, people go to parties, that feasts, and they eat, and they drink, and they enjoy themselves. But money answereth all things. That's a peculiar passage. I remember I was talking to a pastor, and he might have been a missionary, or he was trying to raise money for a missions project. And he said, hey, I hate to call you and talk about money. And I told him, I said, no, it's okay. Money answereth all things. And he's like, what is that? I was like, Bible? He's like, that's not in the Bible. I was like, no, it's in the Bible. We would think it wouldn't be, right? But there's some good things to learn from that. Money answers all things. It answers all requests. It finds its place into all of our desires. Money picks up the phone and opens doors for all kinds of things. And while that is kind of foreign in our concept sometimes, it's not a bad thing. It's simply a true observation of life under the sun. And here it is. Money makes life easier. I don't think God wants your life to be harder. You know what I mean? I'm not Joel Osteening this up. I'm not prosperity gospel. You know, it's so funny to me. The prosperity gospel is so contingent on you being greedy. Here's what the prosperity gospel says. Hey, and me being greedy. I'm greedy. So I tell you, if you give to me, your greed will be met too. What a perverted way to deal with money. That's not why we give. We don't relate to money because, well, if I give, God's going to make me rich. That's not how it works. But there is something to Solomon's wisdom that money does make life enjoyable. Just like party and food and drinks make life enjoyable, money makes life easier. And here's the thing. We shouldn't live for it, but neither should we just ignore it, right? Stewardship is an important thing. Money makes life easier. How many times, and this is what I was talking about earlier, how many times does Solomon come to this observation of, man, I can't change these things, but go ahead and enjoy your life. How many times has Solomon told us that? Right? How many times has Solomon just gone on and said, hey, eat and drink, be merry, rejoice with your wife, enjoy the, yeah, it's unjust and it's not fair and people who do right, you know, they upset the king and people who do wrong, they get seated on the horse, but you know what? Just enjoy life. And here he tells us there's something to money making life a little bit easier. And so be a good steward of that. Money is a part of every one of these matters, right? We're rejoicing with our families, enjoying the substance of your hands, eating and drinking and enjoying. Money finds its way into that. Money answereth all things. And so steward it wisely. Be faithful and be generous, but then enjoy what he lets you keep. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I've heard preachers be like, you can't have this, you can't do that. And forgive me if I've ever done that or come across that way, but the reality is God's okay with you having money. He's not okay with money having you, but there's a part of life that just, it's a little bit easier when you don't have to stay at when you can extend a vacation or you can stay at a nicer place. There's nothing wrong with that. And Solomon is submitting. That's part of just enjoying life. Now, Solomon's last piece of advice is once again about our speech. Look what he says. And our king, he kind of ties them both together, or our leaders. He says, curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber. Why? And it's a really cool picture. He says, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. You know, the fact of the matter is, when you gossip, God has designed your sin to find you out, right? You spoke it in silence. He says, don't even do it in your own thinking, because something through the grapevine, right? Yeah. The idea here is that some bird's going to fly by, and obviously, This is not a reality. There's no bird that's going to go tell the king what you said, but it would be better for you not to say it than for it to get wings and make its way there. No, it was just in a bedchamber. We were in private, me and my friend, me and them. Well, again, that you're going to swallow up your own self. Your words and your tongue, God designed it. If we do it wrong, it makes its way out. And maybe we've all experienced that. I would probably submit that we have. No man is perfect. The one that doesn't offend in tongue, the same as a perfect man. But we've all probably done that. I've done that, where, man, I say something and I'm like, oh, man, what if they heard me? Am I the only person that's ever been there? Probably. It's probably just me. But the reality is God designed it that way. And that fear, the righteous are as bold as a lion, but the wicked flee when no man pursueth, right? So there's when you say the right things and don't say the wrong things, you never have to watch your back, worry about what gets said to who. What a peaceful life to live without having to constantly play catch up with all your words and all the fires you started, right? Be careful with your words and be careful with authority, whether that be your boss or the king or however you want to apply that. So let's pray when we dismiss tonight.